This documentary examines the historical trajectories of communism, socialism, and Marxism, ideologies that have profoundly influenced global politics and society. From their origins in the 19th century to their implementation in various nations, we will explore the key ideas, notable leaders, and the impact these movements have had on millions. Through critical analysis and diverse perspectives, we aim to understand the complexities, challenges, and controversies surrounding these political ideologies and their lasting consequences. Join me, Josh Reeves, for my 49th documentary film, Death from the Left: Socialism, Marxism, and Communism. The roots of socialism can be traced back to early 19th century thought. Although its ideas can be found in earlier philosophies such as those of Plato and Thomas More, the Industrial Revolution in the late 18th to early 19th century brought about significant economic and social changes, leading to a growing awareness of class disparities. This period saw the rise of a working class that faced harsh working conditions, prompting thinkers to propose alternatives to capitalism. The early socialist movements emerged in response to these conditions. Figures such as Charles Fourier, Robert Owen, and Henry de Saint-Simon were among the first to articulate visions of society based on cooperative principles. They aimed to create ideal communities where goods were shared and produced based on need rather than on profit. In the mid-19th century, Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels introduced a more systematic critique of capitalism, co-authoring the Communist Manifesto in 1848. They argued that history is defined by class struggle, and that the working class would eventually overthrow the bourgeoisie to establish a classless society. Karl Marx, a German philosopher, economist, and political theorist, whose ideas laid the groundwork for modern socialism and communism, wrote major works including Das Kapital and The German Ideology. Marx proposed that material conditions and economic factors drive historical development, encapsulated in the concept of a dialectical materialism. Central to Marx's theory is the idea that societal change occurs through the conflict between different social classes, ultimately leading to revolutionary change.
Now, as far as socialism is concerned, that term has been so evacuated of content over the last century that it's hard even to use. I mean, the Soviet Union, for example, was called a socialist society. And it was called that by the two major propaganda operations in the world, the U.S., the Western one, and the Soviet one. They both called it socialism for opposite reasons. The West called it socialism in order to defame socialism by associating it with this miserable tyranny. The Soviet Union called it socialism in order to gain whatever, to benefit from the moral appeal that true socialism had among large parts of the general world population. But this was about as remote from socialism as you can imagine. I mean, the core notion of at least traditional socialism is that what you mentioned, that working people have to be in control of production and communities have to be in control of their own lives and so on. And you know, this goes the Soviet Union was the exact opposite of that. Working people had no control over anything. They were virtual slaves. And the collapse of the Soviet Union is, in fact, a small victory for socialism, in my opinion. It eliminated one of the major barriers to it and should have been recognized as such. But the term has been, as I said, become so meaningless that it's hard even to use. If we use it in the traditional sense, which you brought up, that goes straight back in American history. You read the working class press in the mid 19th century. You know, press published by artisans and what were called factory girls, young women from the farms working in the textile mills in eastern Massachusetts, which was the center of the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. Their press was calling for. They said their theme was that those who work in the mills ought to own them. Wage labor, which was called wage slavery, was regarded by most Americans as not very different from slavery. Even the Republican Party regarded wage labor as just at best a preliminary to free labor, but intolerable because it's a kind of servitude. A large part of the northern population fighting the Civil War was fighting under that banner. This goes straight through the 20th century, the idea that people should be in control of their own destinies and lives, including the institutions in which they work, the communities in which they live, and so on. Call it what name you want, but that's traditional socialism. And there are today attempts to describe a kind of a detailed vision of the future based on these notions. The most extensive and detailed one I know is by Michael Albert at Zenit, which you mentioned. It's participatory economics, and there are other such proposals. But I think this is deeply, you know, deeply ingrained in people's understanding and consciousness and barely below the surface. In fact, it's a call for essentially extension of democracy to the industrial sphere and to communities as well. We should also bear in mind that the leading American social philosopher, John Dewey, who's, you know, as mainstream as apple pie, his main work was concentrated on democracy. He pointed out over and over again that as long as we have what he called industrial feudalism, that is a tyrannical control, private power controlling production and commerce, democracy will be very limited. We have to move to what he called industrial democracy if we hope to have significant democracy. As for politics, his position was that until that happens, politics will be the shadow cast over society by big business. And I think most of the population recognizes that and accepts it.
In 1864, the International Working Men's Association was founded to unite various socialist and labor movements. It sought to promote workers' rights and international solidarity. The the late 19th and early 20th centuries saw the formation of socialist parties across Europe and the German Social Democratic Party being one of the most influential. The Second International was established in 1889 to coordinate the socialist activities worldwide, promoting the idea of a revolutionary change through democratic means. The Russian Revolution of 1917 was a pivotal moment for Marxism. The Bolsheviks, led by Vladimir Lenin, seized power in October, establishing the first communist state. Lenin adapted Marxist theory to the conditions of Russia, emphasizing a vanguard party to lead the working class revolution. His work, What is to be Done, outlined the need for a disciplined party structure to guide workers toward revolution. Following the revolution, the Bolshevik regime implemented policies to nationalize industry and redistribute land. The Russian Civil War from 1917 to 1922 ensued, leading to the establishment of the Soviet Union in 1922. Joseph Stalin later rose to power and introduced policies of rapid industrialization and collectivization, resulting in significant economic changes, but also widespread suffering and repression. After World War II, communism spread to various countries, including China, Cuba, Vietnam, and several Eastern European nations. Each adopted their own interpretation of Marxism, often influenced by local conditions. In China, Mao Zedong developed Maoism, emphasizing peasant-based revolution, which contrasted with traditional Marxists focused on the urban working class. The Chinese Communist Party took power in 1949 after a prolonged civil war.
What I did instead was return to what I regarded as the original cause of all the trouble, let's say, which was the Communist Manifesto. And what I attempted to do, because that's Marx, and we're here to talk about Marxism, let's say. And what I tried to do was read it. And to read something, you don't just follow the words and follow the meaning, but you take apart the sentences and you ask yourself at this level of phrase and at the level of sentence and at the level of paragraph, is this true? Are there counter arguments that can be put forward that are credible? Is this solid thinking? And I have to tell you, and I'm not trying to be flippant here, that I have rarely read a tract. Now, I read it when I was 18. It was a long time ago, right? That's 40 years ago. But I've rarely read a tract that made as many errors per sentence, conceptual errors per sentence, as the Communist Manifesto. It was quite a miraculous reread. It was interesting to think about it psychologically as well, because I've read student papers that were of the same ilk in some sense, although I'm not suggesting that they were of the same level of glittering literary brilliance and polemic quality. And I also understand that the Communist Manifesto was a call for revolution and not a standard logical argument. But that notwithstanding, I have some things to say about the authors psychologically. The first thing is that it doesn't seem to me that either Marx or Engels grappled with this particular fundamental truth, which is that almost all ideas are wrong. And so it doesn't matter if they're your ideas or someone else's ideas, they're probably wrong. And even if they strike you with the force of brilliance, your job is to assume, first of all, that they're probably wrong, and then to assault them with everything you have in your arsenal and see if they can survive. And what struck me about the Communist Manifesto was it was akin to something Jung said about typical thinking, and this was the thinking of people who weren't trained to think. He said that the typical thinker has a thought, it appears to them like an object might appear in a room. The thought appears, and then they just accept it as true. They don't go the second step, which is to think about the thinking. And that's the real essence of critical thinking. And so that's what you try to teach people in university, is to read a text and to think about it critically, not to destroy the utility of the text, but to separate the wheat from the chaff. And so what I tried to do when I was reading the Communist Manifesto was to separate the wheat from the chaff. And I'm afraid I found some wheat, yes, but mostly chaff. And I'm going to explain why, hopefully in relatively short order. So I'm going to outline 10 of the fundamental axioms of the Communist Manifesto. And so these are truths that are basically held as self-evident by the authors. And they're truths that are presented in some sense as unquestioned. And I'm going to question them and tell you why I think they're unreliable. Now, we should remember that this tract was actually written 170 years ago. That's a long time ago. And we have learned a fair bit from since then about human nature, about society, about politics, about economics. There's lots of mysteries left to be solved, but we are slightly wiser, I presume, than we were at one point. And so you can forgive the authors to some degree for what they didn't know, but that doesn't matter given that the essence of this doctrine is still held as sacrosanct by a large proportion of academics, probably are among the most, what would you call, guilty of that particular sin. So here's proposition number one. History is to be viewed primarily as an economic class struggle. All right, so let's think about that for a minute. First of all, the proposition is that history is primarily to be viewed through an economic lens, and I think that's a debatable proposition because there are many other motivations that drive human beings than economics, and those have to be taken into account, especially that drive people other than economic competition, like economic cooperation, for example. And so that's a problem. The other problem is that it's actually not nearly a pessimistic enough description of the actual problem, because history, this is to give the devil his due. The idea that one of the driving forces between history is hierarchical struggle is absolutely true. But the idea that that's actually history is not true, because it's deeper than history. It's biology itself, because organisms of all sorts organize themselves into hierarchies. And one of the problems with hierarchies is that they tend to arrange themselves into a winner-take-all situation. And that is implicit in some sense in Marx's thinking, because of course Marx believed that in a capitalist society, capital would accumulate in the hands of fewer and fewer people, and that actually is in keeping with the nature of hierarchical organizations. Now, the problem with that isn't so much the fact of there's accuracy in the accusation that that is a eternal form of motivation for struggle, but it's an underestimation of the seriousness of the problem because it attributes it to the structure of human societies rather than the deeper reality of the existence of hierarchical structures per se, which, as they also characterize the animal kingdom to a large degree, are clearly not only human constructions. And the idea that there's hierarchical competition among human beings, there's evidence for that that goes back at least to the Paleolithic times. And so that's the next problem. It's that, well, this ancient problem of hierarchical structure is clearly not attributable to capitalism because it existed long in human history before capitalism existed, and then it predated human history itself. So the question then arises, why would you necessarily, at least implicitly, link the class struggle with capitalism, given that it's a far deeper problem? And now, it's also, you've got to understand that this is a deeper problem for people on the left, not just for people on the right. It is the case that hierarchical structures dispossess those people who are at the bottom, those creatures who are at the bottom, speaking, say, of animals, but those people who are at the bottom, and that is a fundamental existential problem. But the other thing that Marx didn't seem to take into account is that there are far more reasons that human beings struggle than their economic class struggle, even if you build the hierarchical idea into that, which is a more comprehensive way of thinking about it. Human beings struggle with themselves, with the malevolence that's inside themselves, with the evil that they're capable of doing, with the spiritual and psychological warfare that goes on within them. And we're also actually always at odds with nature. And this never seems to show up in Marx. And it doesn't show up in Marxism in general. It's as if nature doesn't exist. The primary conflict, as far as I'm concerned, or a primary conflict that human beings engage in, is the struggle for life in a cruel and harsh natural world. And it's as if that doesn't exist in the Marxist domain. If human beings have a problem, it's because there's a class struggle that's essentially economic. It's like, no, human beings have problems because we come into the life starving and lonesome. And we have to solve that problem continually, and we make our social arrangements, at least in part, to ameliorate that, as well as to upon occasion, exacerbate it. And so there's also very little understanding in the Communist Manifesto that any of the, like, say, hierarchical organizations that human beings have put together might have a positive element. And that's an absolute catastrophe, because hierarchical structures are actually necessary to solve complicated social problems. We have to organize ourselves in some manner. And you have to give the devil his due. And so it is the case that hierarchies dispossess people, and that's a big problem. That's the fundamental problem of inequality. But it's also the case that hierarchies happen to be a very efficient way of distributing resources. And it's finally the case that human hierarchies are not fundamentally predicated on power. And I would say the biological, anthropological data on that are crystal clear. You don't rise to a position of authority that's reliable in a human society primarily by exploiting other people. It's a very unstable means of obtaining power. So that's a problem. Well, the people that laugh might do it that way. Okay, now another problem that comes up right away is that Marx also assumes that you can think about history as a binary class struggle with clear divisions between, say, the proletariat and the bourgeoisie. And that's actually a problem, because it's not so easy to make a firm division between who's exploiter and who's exploitee, let's say, because it's not obvious, like in the case of small shareholders, let's say, whether or not they happen to be part of the oppressed or part of the oppressor. This actually turned out to be a big problem in the Russian Revolution. And by big problem, I mean tremendously big problem. Because it turned out that you could fragment people into multiple identities, and that's a fairly easy thing to do, and you could usually find some axis along which they were part of the oppressor class. It might have been a consequence of their education, or it might have been a consequence of the wealth that they strived to accumulate during their life, or it might have been a consequence of the fact that they had parents or grandparents who were educated or rich, or that they were a member of the priesthood, or that they were socialists, or anyways, the listing of how it was possible for you to be bourgeois instead of proletariat grew immensely, and that was one of the reasons that the Red Terror claimed all the victims that it claimed. And so that was a huge problem. It was probably most exemplified by the demolition of the kulaks, who were basically peasant farmers, although effective ones in the Soviet Union, who had managed to raise themselves out of serfdom over a period of about 40 years and to gather some degree of material security about them. And about 1.8 million of them were exiled. About 400,000 were killed. And the net consequence of that removal of their private property because of their bourgeois status was arguably the death of 6 million Ukrainians in the famines of the 1930s. And so the binary class struggle idea, that was a bad idea. That was a very, very bad idea. It's also bad in this way, and this is a real sleight of hand that Marx pulls off, is you have a binary class division, proletariat and bourgeoisie, and you have an implicit idea that all of the good is on the side of the proletariat and all of the evil is on the side of the bourgeoisie. And that's classic group identity thinking. You know, it's one of the reasons I don't like identity politics, is because once you divide people into groups and pit them against one another, it's very easy to assume that all the evil in the world can be attributed to one group, the hypothetical oppressors, and all the good to the other. And that... Well, and that's naive beyond comprehension, because it's absolutely foolish to make the presumption that you can identify someone's moral worth with their economic standing. So, and that actually turned out to be a real problem as well, because Marx also came up with this idea, which is a crazy idea as far as I can tell, that's a technical term, crazy idea, of the dictatorship of the proletariat. And that's the next idea that I really stumbled across. It was like, okay, so what's the problem? Well, the problem is the capitalists own everything. They own all the means of production. And they're oppressing everyone. And that would be all the workers. And there's going to be a race to the bottom of wages for the workers as the capitalists strive to extract more and more value from the labor of the proletariat by competing with other capitalists to drive wages downward, which, by the way, didn't happen, partly because wage earners can become scarce, and that actually drives the market value upward. But the fact that you assume a priori that all the evil can be attributed to the capitalists and all the good, the bourgeoisie, and all the good could be attributed to the proletariat meant that you could hypothesized that a dictatorship of the proletariat could come about, and that was the first stage in the communist revolution. And remember, this is a call for revolution, and not just revolution, but bloody, violent revolution, and the overthrowing of all existent social structures. Anyways, the problem with that, you see, is that because all the evil isn't divided so easily up into oppressor and oppressed, that when you do establish a dictator of the proletariat to the degree that you can do that, which you actually can't because it's technically impossible and an absurd thing to consider to begin with, not least because of the problem of centralization, I mean, you have to hypothesize that you can take away all the property of the capitalists. You can replace the capitalist class with a minority of proletariats. How they're going to be chosen isn't exactly clear in the Communist Manifesto. That none of the people who are from the proletariat class are going to be corrupted by that sudden access to power, because they're, well, by definition, good. So then you have the good people who are running the world, and you also have them centralized so that they can make decisions that are insanely complicated to make, in fact, impossibly complicated to make. And so that's a failure conceptually on both dimensions, because, first of all the proletariat aren't going to be good. And when you give put people in the same position as the evil capitalists, especially if you believe that social pressure is one of the determining factors of human character, which the Marxists certainly believe, then why wouldn't you assume that the proletariat would immediately become as or more corrupt than the capitalists, which is, of course, I would say exactly what happened every time this experiment was run. And then the next problem is, well, what makes you think that you can take some system as complicated as, like, capitalist free market society and centralize that and put decision-making power in the hands of a few people, the mechanisms by, without specifying the mechanisms by which you're going to choose them, like, what makes you think they're going to have the wisdom or the ability to do what the capitalists were doing, unless you assume, as Marx did, that all of the evil was with the capitalists and all the good was with the proletariats, and that nothing that capitalists did constituted valid labor, which is another thing that Marx assumed, which is palpably absurd, because people who are, like, maybe if you're a dissolute aristocrat from 1830 and or earlier, and you run a feudal estate and all you do is spend your time gambling and chasing prostitutes, well, then your labor value is zero. But if you're running a business and it's a successful business, first of all, you're a bloody fool to exploit your workers, because even if you're greedy as sin, because you're not going to extract the maximum amount of labor out of them by doing that. And the notion that you're adding no productive value as a manager rather than a capitalist it's absolutely absurd. All it does is indicate that you either know nothing whatsoever about how an actual business works, or you refuse to know anything about how an actual business works. So that's... That's also a big problem. So then the next problem is the criticism of profit. It's like, well, what's wrong with profit exactly? What's the problem with profit? Well, the idea from the Marxist perspective was that profit was theft. No, but profit, well, can be theft, because crooked people can run companies, and so sometimes profit is theft, but that certainly doesn't mean that it's always theft. What it means, in part at least, if the capitalist is adding value to the corporation, then there's some utility and some fairness in him or her extracting the value of their abstract labor, their thought, their abstract abilities, their ability to manage the company and to engage in proper competition and product development and efficiency and the proper treatment of the workers and all of that. And then if they can create a profit, well, then they have a little bit of security for times that aren't so good. And that seems absolutely bloody necessary as far as I'm concerned. And then the next thing is, well, how can you grow if you don't have a profit? And if you have an enterprise that's valuable and worthwhile, and some enterprises are valuable and worthwhile, then it seems to me that a little bit of profit to help you grow seems to be the right approach. And so, and then the other issue with profit, and you know this if you've ever run a business, is it's a really useful constraint. You know, like, it's not enough to have a good idea. It's not enough to have a good idea and a sales and marketing plan and then to implement that and all of that. That's bloody difficult. Like, it's not easy to have a good idea. And it's not easy to come up with a good sales and marketing plan. And it's not easy to find customers and satisfy them. And so if you allow profit to constitute a limitation on what it is that you might reasonably attempt, it provides a good constraint on wasted labor. And so most of the things that I've done in my life, even psychologically, that were designed to help people's psychological health, I tried to run on a for-profit basis. And the reason for what that was, apart from the fact that I'm not averse to making a profit, partly so my enterprises can grow, but was also so that there were forms of stupidity that I couldn't engage in because I would be punished by the market enough to eradicate the enterprise. And so... Okay, and then so the next issue, this is a weird one. So Marx and Engels also assume that this dictatorship of the proletariat, which involves absurd centralization, the overwhelming probability of corruption and impossible computation, as the proletariat now try to rationally compute the manner in which an entire market economy could run, which cannot be done because it's far too complicated for anybody to think through. The next theory is that somehow the proletariat dictatorship would become magically hyperproductive. And there's actually no theory at all about how that's going to happen. And so I had to infer the theory, and the theory seems to be that once you eradicate the bourgeoisie because they're evil, and you get rid of their private property, and you eradicate the profit motive, then all of a sudden, magically, the small percentage of the proletariat who now run the society determine how they can make their productive enterprises productive enough so they become hyperproductive. Now, and they need to become hyperproductive for the last error to be logically coherent in relationship to the Marxist theory, which is that at some point the proletariat, the dictatorship of the proletariat, will become so hyperproductive that there'll be enough material goods for everyone across all dimensions. And when that happens, then what people will do is spontaneously engage in meaningful creative labor, which is what they had been alienated from in the capitalist horror show, and the utopia will be magically ushered in. But there's no indication about how that hyperproductivity is going to come about, and there's also no understanding that, well, that isn't the utopia that is going to suit everyone, because there are great differences between people. And some people are going to find what they want in love, and some are going to find it in social being, and some are going to find it in conflict and competition, and some are going to find it in creativity, as Marx pointed out. But the notion that will necessarily be the end goal for the utopian state is preposterous. And then there's the Dostoevskian observation too, which is one not to be taken lightly, which is, well, what sort of shallow conception of people do you have that makes you think that if you gave people enough bread and cake, in the Dostoevskian terms, and nothing to do with except to busy themselves with the continuity of the species, that they would also all of a sudden become peaceful and heavenly? Dostoevsky's idea was that, you know, we were built for trouble. And if we were ever handed everything we needed on a silver platter, the first thing we would do is engage in some form of creative destruction just so something unexpected could happen, just so we could have the adventure of our lives. And I think there's something to be said for that. So, and then the last error, let's say, although by no means the last, was this, and this is one of the strangest parts of the Communist Manifesto, is Marx admits, and Engels admit repeatedly in the Communist Manifesto, that there has never been a system of production in the history of the world that was as effective at producing material commodities in excess than capitalism. Like, that's extensively documented in the Communist Manifesto. And so if your proposition is, look, we got to get as much material security for everyone as possible, as fast as we can, and capitalism already seems to be doing that at a rate that's unparalleled in human history, wouldn't the logical thing be just to let the damn system play itself out? I mean, unless you're assuming that the evil capitalists are just going to take all of the flat screen televisions and put them in one big room and not let anyone else have one. The logical assumption is that, well, you're already on a road that's supposed to produce the proper material productivity. And so, well, that's 10 reasons, as far as I can tell, that, and so what I saw in that the Communist Manifesto is like seriously flawed in virtually every way it could possibly be flawed. And also all evidence that Marx was the kind of narcissistic thinker who could think. He was a very intelligent person, and so was Engels. But what he thought when he thought was that what he thought was correct. And he never went the second stage, which is, well, wait a second, how could all of this go terribly wrong? And if you're a thinker, especially a sociological thinker, especially a thinker on the broad scale, a social scientist, for example, one of your moral obligations is to think, you know, you might be wrong about one of your fundamental axioms, or two, or three, or ten. And as a consequence, you have the moral obligation to walk through the damn system and think, Well, what if I'm completely wrong here and things invert and go exactly the wrong way? And like, I just can't understand how anybody could come up with an idea like the dictatorship of the proletariat, especially after advocating its implementation with violent means, which is a direct part of the Communist Manifesto, and actually think, if they were thinking, if they knew anything about human beings and the proclivity for malevolence that's part and parcel of the individual human being, that could do anything but lead to a special form of hell, which is precisely what did happen. And so I'm going to close, because I have 3 minutes, with a bit of evidence as well that Marx also thought that what would happen inevitably as a consequence of capitalism is the rich would get richer and the poor would get poorer. So there would be inequality. The first thing I'd like to say is we do not know how to set up a human system of economics without inequality. No one has ever managed it, including the communists. And the form of inequality changed. And it's not obvious by any stretch of imagination that the free market economies of the West have more inequality than the less free economies in the rest of the world. And the one thing you can say about capitalism is that although it produces inequality, which it absolutely does, it also produces wealth. And all the other systems don't. They just produce inequality. So here's a few stats. Here's a few free market stats, okay? From 1800 to 2017, income growth adjusted for inflation grew by 40 times for production workers and 16 times for unskilled labor. GDP rose by a factor of about 0.5 from 1 AD to 1800. So from 1 AD to 1800 AD, it was like nothing, flat. And then all of a sudden, in the last 217 years, there's been this unbelievably upward movement of wealth. And it doesn't only characterize the tiny percentage of people at the top who, admittedly, do have most of the wealth. The question is, not only, though, what's the inequality? The question is, well, what's happening to the absolutely poor at the bottom? And the answer to that is, they're getting richer faster now than they ever have in the history of the world. And we're eradicating poverty in countries that have adopted moderate free market policies at a rate that's unparalleled. So here's an example. The UN millennial, one of the UN millennial goals was to reduce the rate of absolute poverty in the world by 50% between 2000 and 2015. And they defined that as $1.90 a day. Pretty low, you know, but you have to start somewhere. We hit that at 2012. 3 years ahead of schedule. And you might be cynical about that and say, well, it's kind of an arbitrary number, but the curves are exactly the same at $3.80 a day and $7.60 a day. Not as many people have hit that, but the rate of increase towards that is the same. The bloody UN thinks that we'll be out of poverty defined by $1.90 a day by the year 2030. It's unparalleled. And so the rich may be getting richer, but the poor are getting richer too. And that's not the... Look, I'll leave it at that, because I'm out of time. But I'll leave it with this. The poor are not getting poorer under capitalism. The poor are getting richer under capitalism by a large margin. And I'll leave you with one statistic, which is that now, in Africa, the child mortality rate in Africa now is the same as the child mortality rate was in Europe in 1952. And so that's happened within the span of one lifetime. And so if you're for the poor, if you're actually concerned that the poorest people in the world rise above their starvation levels, then all the evidence suggests that the best way to do that is to implement something approximating a free market economy.
the Cold War, 1947 to 1991, was marked by ideological conflict between the capitalist West, led by the United States, and the communist East, led by the Soviet Union. This period saw proxy wars, a nuclear arms race, and significant political tensions. The Warsaw Pact in 1955 solidified the Soviet bloc, while NATO in 1949 represented the Western Alliance. The late 20th century witnessed a decline in communist states, particularly with the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989 and the dissolution of the Soviet Union in 1991. These events marked the end of the Cold War and led to significant political and economic reforms in the former communist countries. The adaptation of socialist principles in various forms continues today as modern leftist movements advocate for democratic socialism, eco-socialism, and other variations. Today, socialism has seen a resurgence in various parts of the world, with movements advocating for wealth redistribution, social justice, and environmental sustainability. The resurgence of socialism has been evident in many countries, particularly among younger generations who advocate for progressive policies in response to issues like income inequality, climate change, and social justice. Political figures such as Bernie Sanders in the United States and Jeremy Corbyn in the United Kingdom have popularized democratic socialism, emphasizing policies like universal health care, tuition-free education, and wealth redistribution within a democratic framework. In the early 21st century, several Latin American countries saw the rise of leftist governments advocating for socialism in the 21st century. Leaders like Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, Evo Morales in Bolivia, and Rafael Correa in Ecuador focused on social welfare programs and reducing poverty while often criticizing U.S. intervention in the region. The Nordic and Scandinavian countries have implemented social democratic policies that blend capitalism with strong social welfare systems, often cited as successful examples of socialism. These nations provide extensive social services while maintaining a competitive market economy. In academia, Marxism has evolved into various schools of thought, including cultural Marxism, eco-Marxism, and post-Marxism, each addressing contemporary issues through a Marxist lens. Scholars like Antonio Gramsci introduced concepts such as cultural hegemony, which analyzes how societal norms and values maintain their dominance over capitalist ideologies. Both socialism and Marxism have faced critiques from various perspectives. Critics argue that socialist systems can lead to authoritarianism, inefficiency, and a lack of innovation due to state control over the economy. Marxist predictions about the inevitable fall of capitalism have also faced challenges, as capitalism has demonstrated its resilience and adaptability, incorporating some socialistic elements to address inequalities.
We're here with our friend Pete Hegseth. Pete Hegseth, Kamala Harris, you see what's going on in the world. Afghanistan, we know what took place there. It was horrendous. Even Iraq now is really part of the Iranian hegemony. You see what's going on with the Houthis. We can't even use the Red Sea anymore. They've cut it off, and we haven't pushed back. Hezbollah has effectively conquered Lebanon and shooting missiles into Israel. Hamas will not surrender and will not surrender the hostages. Communist China is threatening Japan, Australia, the Philippines, South Korea, Vietnam, and of course Taiwan. Russia is constantly threatening us with nuclear attack. Meanwhile, we are debasing our military. The Communist Chinese now have more ships than we do, and they're not stopping, and we are. Is this the right time to have Kamala Harris as Commander-in-Chief?
Well, you laid it out as best I've heard it. Of course not. First of all, she's a Marxist at home. And then she's a globalist and apologist overseas. And, you know, most empires lose their influence around the world because they lose their compass at home. That certainly happened under Obama. It's fast-forwarded under Biden. And under Marxist Kamala Harris, Comrade Kamala, it would accelerate. We know exactly who she is. She is a radical, cratering our sense of self, our southern border, our national identity, our love of country, and certainly our military, as you've talked about, as I wrote about in the War on Warriors. When all of that happens, the world takes notice. And Obama went on that apology tour where America was no longer leading boldly. Biden has just been basically AWOL and not believing in American leadership. And then through the small actions he has taken, he signaled complete retreat. And Kamala Harris will be deferential to institutions like the UN, like UNRWA, all these organizations captured by leftists that don't serve American interests. And our influence abroad will continue to diminish. So our allies, like Taiwan, like Israel, like a shrinking number of countries, are going to turn to having to do things themselves because they can't count on America. And that's when our enemies pile on. And when the global order, and I use that in not capitalized, because I don't want a global order controlled by elites, but when after World War II, the U.S. sort of took control of that, that's all going to shift with China, with Russia, with the Islamists teaming up against us. And Kamala Harris has no plan to defend America's interests, so the world will be on fire, Mark. What you just laid out will sound like tiddlywinks compared to the possibility of World War III under a feckless, weak leader like Kamala Harris.
Thank you very much. A number of years ago, I heard a young father, a very prominent young man in the entertainment world, addressing a tremendous gathering in California. It was during the time of the Cold War, and communism and our own way of life were very much in people's minds, and he was speaking to that subject. And suddenly, though, I heard him saying, I love my little girls more than anything, and I said to myself, oh, no, don't. You can't. Don't say that. But I had underestimated him. He went on, I would rather see my little girls die now, still believing in God, than have them grow up under communism and one day die no longer believing in God. There were thousands of young people in that audience. They came to their feet with shouts of joy. They had instantly recognized the profound truth in what he had said with regard to the physical and the soul and what was truly important. Yes, let us pray for the salvation of all of those who live in that totalitarian darkness. Pray they will discover the joy of knowing God. But until they do, let us be aware that while they preach the supremacy of the state, declare its omnipotence over individual man, and predict its eventual domination of all peoples on the earth, they are the focus of evil in the modern world. It was C.S. Lewis who, in his unforgettable Screwtape Letters, wrote, "The greatest evil is not done now in those sordid dens of crime that Dickens loved to paint. It is not even done in concentration camps and labor camps. In those, we see its final result. But it is conceived and ordered, moved, seconded, carried, and minuted in clear, carpeted, warmed, and well-lighted offices by quiet men with white collars and cut fingernails and smooth-shaven cheeks who do not need to raise their voice. Well, because these quiet men do not raise their voices, because they sometimes speak in soothing tones of brotherhood and peace, because like other dictators before them, they're always making their final territorial demand, some would have us accept them at their word and accommodate ourselves to their aggressive impulses. But if history teaches anything, it teaches that simple-minded appeasement or wishful thinking about our adversaries is folly. It means the betrayal of our past, the squandering of our freedom. So I urge you to speak out against those who would place the United States in a position of military and moral inferiority. You know, I've always believed that old Screwtape reserved his best efforts for those of you in the church. So in your discussions of the nuclear freeze proposals, I urge you to beware the temptation of pride, the temptation of blithely declaring yourselves above it all and label both sides equally at fault, to ignore the facts of history and the aggressive impulses of an evil empire, to simply call the arms race a giant misunderstanding, and thereby remove yourself from the struggle between right and wrong and good and evil.
Now, Nietzsche said back in the late 1800s that after he said that God was dead, and I suppose that would also mean the theory that of suffering that I outlined at the beginning that is at the basis of Judeo-Christian civilization, that God was dead and that people had killed him and that we'd never find enough water to wash away the blood. It's a paraphrase, but I've got the basic message right. And he also said there'll be two consequences of that: nihilism, because there's no transcendent meaning, and a move to totalitarianism because people can't tolerate nihilism. And he said the most likely pathway to totalitarianism would be communism, essentially. He didn't quite use those words, but he meant that. The words are close enough. He said socialism, but I'm going to use communism to distinguish it from democratic socialism. And he said that probably tens of millions of people would die in the 20th century as we played out that experiment. And then he said, but it might be worth it if we learn something from it. Rough, man. I mean, and unbelievable. Like, I cannot figure out how in the world he knew that that was going to happen, especially so far in advance. But Dostoevsky knew the same thing. He wrote this book called The Devils or The Possessed. You could read that. That's a great book. It takes about 150 pages to get going. But once everything snaps together after that, you know, and then it moves. And it's basically his prophecy about, it's an examination of the kind of person who had arisen in the aftermath of the death of God in Russia, who would lead the communist revolution. That's essentially it. It's brilliant. It's terrifying. And it's a great intro to Solzhenitsyn's Gulag Archipelago, which describes what did happen when those sort of people took over the revolution. So let's look at what happened after the revolution. And we might say, well, how about we replicate the experiment a few times? Because you know how it is. If you're running a scientific experiment, you want to find out what something does if you allow it to behave. You don't want to just run it once because, well, maybe there was something specific about those conditions that led to the outcome. You want to generalize it across multiple circumstances. So we might say, well, let's take this set of ideas and let's run it on a large scale over a very long period of time in a variety of exceptionally diverse cultures and languages. So let's do that. Okay, well, we could first start with the Soviets. People, even now, because it's like the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution, are celebrating Lenin. It's like, that's not good. That's like celebrating Hitler. Okay, I'm dead serious about that. It's not good. And the fact that people can dare to think that that's okay means that there's something wrong with the way that we look at history. Lenin was a monster. And if you want to know about that, you can read Solzhenitsyn's writings about Lenin. Because the communist apologists say, well, it wasn't Lenin. Lenin was a good guy. He was all motivated by love of the working class. It's like, well, his henchman was Stalin. And if your henchman is Stalin, you're not a good guy. And Lenin was around during the early collectivization. And if you read what he wrote, you'll find out that he was perfectly willing to have any number of people die as long as his ideological system could be brought into being. So there's no celebrating Lenin. There's no we're cool, young, Marxist, hip revolutionaries, and he's our idol. It's like, there's none of that. Not if you know anything. Not if you're decent. Well, there was the death of the kulaks. I told you about that. There was the Ukrainian famine. That's 6 million gone there. There was the rise of the Gulag state because it turned out that Russia, the Soviet Union, couldn't run on the principles that it had laid down as sacrosanct. They just didn't work, so you had to enslave everybody and run your economy as a slave state, essentially, and try not to kill the people in the gulags so fast that you can't suck some productive labor out of them. It was the death of tens of millions of people. We don't even know. The estimates range from 15 to 60 million. And like, we won't get too picky about the numbers because after the first 10 million, you kind of made your point. And the fact that we don't know between 15 and 60 is actually an indication of the horror of it. Because our count is off by tens of millions. And that's only within the last century. And then there was the 1956 crackdown on Hungary and the 1968 invasion of Czechoslovakia. Then there was the whole, like, thermonuclear holocaust thing that was going on at the same time, and the fact that in 1962 and in 1984 we were seconds away from complete annihilation, right? During the Cuban Missile Crisis, the keys were in the intercontinental ballistic missile release systems, and Castro, as he admitted to Jimmy Carter, in case any of you are Castro fans, which you shouldn't be, that he was perfectly willing to have Cuba annihilated if it would have meant the defeat of the United States. And then in 1984, approximately, I may have the date exactly wrong, the Russians received an indication from their early warning systems that the Americans had launched 5 thermonuclear missiles, and one Russian decided that it was a mistake and refused to launch the retaliation. And he just died about 2 weeks ago. So, you know, that was pretty close. And so that was experiment number one, let's say. That wasn't good, that experiment. Let's put it that way. It wasn't good. It was exactly the antithesis of good. It was precisely the antithesis of good. But that wasn't all. I mean, there's the People's Republic of China. That's a different country, like seriously a different country, right? Different tradition, different language. How many people died in China under Mao? No one knows. Same issue with the Soviet Union, although Mao was a bigger monster than Stalin, and that's impressive, you know, because there's Hitler, there's Stalin, and there's Mao. And of the three, Mao was probably the worst. He's still revered in China. Maybe that accounts for their affinity for North Korea, which could still destroy us all, the remnants of that horrible state. Maybe 100 million people died in China during the Great Leap Forward. That's a hell of a leap forward. Well, maybe it wasn't 100 million, you know, maybe it was only 40 million. But as I said before, when you're counting in the tens of millions, your point's already made. And then there was Cambodia and the killing fields and Bulgaria and East Germany and Romania and the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, that's North Korea, and Vietnam and Ethiopia, Hungary, etc., etc., etc. There was never a successful communist state. Cuba, I suppose, came closest, but it was radically... the Soviets poured money into Cuba, so that doesn't really count. So then the first question was, well, are these Marxists motivated by love or hatred? Well, is it love or hatred that produces 100 million dead people? And is that enough evidence or not? And if it's not enough evidence, if you think to yourself, well, that's not enough evidence, it was never really given its proper, a proper try. It's like, well, what would have been a proper try? See, I always think when I hear someone say that, I know what you think. You think in your delusional arrogance that you understand the Marxist doctrines better than anyone else ever has, and that if you were the one implementing those doctrines, you would have ushered in the utopia. That's what you mean when you say that. And, you know, they say, and there's an idea in the New Testament that there's a sin, it's the sin against the Holy Ghost. If you commit that sin, no one really knows what it is, that you can't be forgiven. And I would say, well, if you want a candidate for the sin against the Holy Ghost in the 21st century, the statement, communism, real communism was never tried, with the underlying idea that if you had been the person implementing it, it would have worked, I think that's a pretty good contender for something for which you should never be forgiven.
Current movements often draw from Marxist and socialist principles while addressing modern issues such as gender inequality, racial justice, and environmental sustainability. Organizations like the Democratic Socialists of America advocate for a political approach that incorporates democratic principles with socialist goals, focusing on grassroots activism and electoral politics. Anyone that believes in freedom should be fighting the ideologies of socialism, communism, and Marxism at all cost. And this film is dedicated to those who have and those who do.